Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars.
All of this could have been avoided if we'd followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and here on the Radio Northwest Network. This is Honestly Provocative Talk Radio for the Pacific Northwest. We got a lot to talk about. I'll get to the Matt Lauer controversy in just a moment. And I'll also talk about Pramila Jayapal, who is the newest freshman member of Congress from the state of Washington. And she has now come out and suggested that a longtime, longest-serving member of Congress from Michigan, that he quit, that he stepped down, and I think she's right about that. We'll get to that as well. Why does one Pacific Northwest city have more car thefts per capita than almost any other city in America? It ranks the third in car theft, which is not a positive. We'll talk about that a bit later as well. But I wanted to start with this before we get to Matt Lauer and all that. In Seattle right now, there is a one-day strike by school bus drivers, and it leaves about 12,000 students without yellow bus service to get to school. And I want to ask you this question, and then I'll tell you how I would answer it. Is today's one-day strike by school bus drivers a legitimate tactic of negotiation? The answer is no. It is not a legitimate tactic. Here's the way the Fish Wrapper reports it. Seattle school bus drivers will strike for one day today, leaving 12,000 students without service. Teamsters Local 174. That's right. Look for the union label. The union that represents the district's 400 bus drivers says that bus service will pick up again tomorrow. The leaders said they could call for a longer strike if a deal is not reached with First Student, which is a private company, but is the bus contractor for the Seattle Public Schools. The schools will be open today, but they are sticking to their regular schedules, and they're simply encouraging families to find another way to get their kids to school. Now, I'm not going to argue about whether or not it's legal. I imagine that it's legal, or even if it's not legal, the striking union drivers will get away with it. But under state law, they will receive an unexcused absence. But the students who miss school under this strike are going to get an unexcused absence, but they'll be able to make up classwork. That's assuming that mom and dad did not find another way to get the kids to school. But do you think it's a legitimate method of negotiation to punish children directly and to punish their families indirectly? I think this is one of the uglier elements of union business in America today. That a union will go out and hurt anybody it takes to be able to get what they want. And apparently what they're unhappy about is the health insurance plan that has been offered as part of the negotiations to get them a new contract. Now, if you want to negotiate a new contract, good for you. If you want to belong to a union, that's something that's legal as well. I support your right to make that choice, although I think the choice is a foolish one. You have the right to make the choice. The drivers say they want more affordable health benefits and a stronger retirement plan. Benefits, they say, the company last year promised to address this year. Well, the problem with that is that affordable health benefits, that's largely under the control of the government right now because of what Obamacare has done to the health insurance business. So when you demand of a private company that they change things that are not within their control, all you're really saying is, would you please pick up some additional cost and pay some more money because the government has screwed up health insurance so badly? And if you don't do it, we will go out and we will punish children by taking away their ride to school, and will punish families by forcing those families to find an alternate route to school. So I've made that today's Twitter poll. You can find it online at LarsLarson.com and also on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. It's brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, gravel, sand, and topsoil. Let the Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it and save your aching back. So the question is, Is a one-day strike by school bus drivers a legitimate tactic of negotiation? I would vote to answer that question no. We'll also get to your phone calls and your emails. And, of course, naysayers go to the head of the line on this program. In fact, in the last 3 days, 2 days, we've had an incredible number of naysayers, some of them quite well-spoken, and others who didn't really want to engage in a conversation. I encourage you to do that. And while you're on the website, if that's where you go to vote in the quick poll, visit my trophy room at LarsLarson.com, powered by Northwest Armory. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventure and get the chance to win some fantastic prizes. And if you'd like to weigh in from anywhere in the Pacific Northwest that this network serves, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the number is 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5255. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Shakespeare invented the phrase hoist by his own petard. Now, a petard, you might know, is a small bomb used to blow up the gates of a palace that soldiers wanted to invade. To be hoist by your own petard means literally being blown up by your own bomb. A little more than a year ago, many of those in the mainstream media were throwing sex bombs at Donald Trump, hoping to blow up his presidential ambitions. Trump not only survived those attacks, he prevailed and landed the most important job in the world. Many of his media accusers have not been so fortunate. Late last night, left-wing liberal Matt Lauer of NBC got the word that his own sexual escapades have brought about the end of his $30 million a year media job. Reports this morning say that Lauer got the boot for allegedly sexually assaulting an NBC staffer during the Rio Olympics 3 years ago. And you have to wonder automatically, why didn't that young lady come forward and complain? Because she had seen what happened to young ladies who get crossways with Matt Lauer. They get blown up as well. Lauer now joins a growing list of left-wing media superstars like PBS-CBS pervy old man Charlie Rose, NBC's Mark Halperin, The New York Times' Glenn Thrush, and even NPR totebag news chief Michael Oreskes. Shakespeare would have loved it, and you kind of wonder who's next. And perhaps those people working in today's media have forgot that old adage about those who live in glass houses might not want to be throwing rocks.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
I'm going to award today's Daily Grill to the state energy panel in Washington State that has unanimously voted to recommend disapproving a massive oil-by-rail terminal proposed along the Columbia River. The state's Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, which has been evaluating the project for the last 4 years, finally decided yesterday to tell Governor Inslee to reject the project. This is one of the most foolish things that Washington State has done, but it is what happens in a blue state. Today's best email, but you can always send more, to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Papa's Shoehorns. It's the perfect Christmas gift for everyone. I got one on the web at papashoehorns.com. Matt writes in from Astoria. Lars, after about 5 minutes research, I found an easy way to save taxpayers at least $631 million. I come by this figure as that was last year's operating budget for the CFPB. I've included the CFPB's mission statement, and from what I can tell you, the entire bureau can be replaced by requiring each and every high school graduate to complete a year of accounting and a year of personal finance before getting their diploma. Call it a senior project. I graduated from high school school in 78, and we were required to take personal finance, and the school did offer an accounting class. In personal finance, we learned about the buying of houses and cars, investing in the stock market, preparing a budget, balancing a checkbook, and other consumer practices. In the fight over control of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I find a federal entity that is in reality not necessary and can be easily replaced with a halfway decent personal finance teacher in each and every high school. The one negative aspect of closing the bureau is that I can see all those unemployed donors to the Democrat Party. You're the man, Lars. Signed, Matt in Astoria. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You co-hosted the Today Show with Matt Lauer for 15 years. What is Matt's most annoying habit?
He pinches me on the ass a lot.
That would be Katie Couric talking about Matt Lauer's most annoying habit, which will no longer be annoying at NBC, because sometime last night, he got the word, don't know if it was by a text or by an email or perhaps a phone call. Maybe the boss came out to his place in the Hamptons or his apartment in New York City, and they said, hey, Matt, you know that job for which we pay you over $30 million a year? You just lost it because of some of the things that you have been doing. And I'll tell you what, I think that it is appropriate, given the nature of what's been going on lately, that the media is finally figuring out you're going to have to act quickly when this kind of thing happens. Apparently, the New York Times is right in the middle of preparing a very extensive story about Matt Lauer's history at NBC, and NBC decided to get ahead of that just a little bit. You know, I'm going to jump out to the president, who's live in St. Charles, Missouri, I believe, right now. He's outselling the tax plan, which, by the way, none of your Democrat representatives or senators plans to vote for.
Blaine Lukemeyer. Blaine. Thank you, Blaine. And he was great on television today. I watched him. I got up early and I watched you on. That was a good interview. Thank you. Very much in favor of tax cuts. Jason Smith and Ann.
He's thanking a few of his local supporters. But I want to jump into this when he gets into the argument, because I find this almost comical. There are a lot of Americans who are right now concerned about whether or not that tax plan is going to pass. It's going to make a big difference for an awful lot of Americans. And as I've told you, there have been some great charts out there that show how it's going to affect people. In fact, a friend of mine, Rod, stopped me this morning and he said, hey, how's this going to affect me when I've got a small business? And I told him, I think it's actually going to do right by Americans. Now, there was the lady who called me yesterday who was concerned about not getting a tax cut, but that's because she's in the income range in which you don't pay federal income taxes right now. So you wouldn't expect to get a cut if you weren't paying the taxes to begin with. But for those people who are paying taxes, it sounds like there is a greater proportional tax for those in the middle income ranges than for anyone else. In fact, let's go back to the president here for a second.
The House of Representatives.
He's mentioning the tax cuts have already passed the House.
The eyes of the world now turn to the United States Senate. A successful vote in the Senate this week will bring us one giant step closer to delivering an incredible victory for the American people. Massive tax cuts and reform. I don't even mention the word reform, because people don't know exactly what we're talking about. You know, for years, they have not been able to get tax cuts, many, many years, since Reagan. And the problem was they talked about tax reform, not tax cuts. I said, don't call it reform. Call it tax cuts and reform. So every once in a while, we'll add the name reform. But it's tax cuts. We cannot sit, right? That's the governor agrees.
People love tax cuts.
We cannot sit idly by and watch our selves losing in competition to other countries as they continue to take away our jobs because their tax codes are more competitive and less burdensome than ours.
Yeah, in fact, think about this. The last time America changed its tax system was 1986. And at the time, we created the best corporate tax environment in the world for businesses to locate. We had the best. Now we have one of the worst tax rates in the world, and we need to change that, both for corporations and for individuals. I'm going to get to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Earl in Medford, listening on KMED. Hey, Earl, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, thanks, Lars. Hey, I work for that company, First Student.
Oh, the company that supplies a bus service to Seattle schools, and you do it probably in Medford, right?
I do it in Phoenix Talent, actually. If you go every school district has their own contract with First Student or whatever company they're using.
Right.
And some have their own buses, such as Jackson County does.
Yeah.
But out of the three school districts in this area, only one is union, which is Medford.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all First Student. So not every school bus district has union.
Do you think it's better for you to be a union member or not?
Oh, no, I would not never be. I won't work for Medford because they are union.
Yeah.
Even though they're the same company. Occasionally I'll go over there and have to sub, but I don't come under union rules because I don't work in a union yard.
So I'd pose the question, is today's one-day strike in Seattle by school bus drivers a legitimate tactic of negotiation? Do you think it is?
It's not. The drivers are probably not the ones orchestrating the strike.
Well, it's their union, right?
It doesn't mean they don't have any say in the union. People in unions don't have any say in the
union. Well, I agree with you to some extent, but imagine what you're saying. You belong to a union to represent you, and then you get no say in what the union tells you have to do. Isn't that crazy?
That's why I'm not in a union. But I agree. No, they shouldn't strike. I mean, you know, I have in the morning, just my elementary school kids, I have almost 50 kids on my bus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine 50 kids that can't make it to school because the driver is not going to come in that day?
Nope. I can't.
I mean, I would not do that to the school, the parents, the kids.
God bless you. I'm glad you're not. Let me go to Debbie. Debbie's also calling. Debbie, you called in about the bus strike as well in Seattle. What do you say?
I agree with the driver ahead of time. I've worked for First Student ever since they took over from Ryder Transportation, and it's exactly what the caller ahead of me said. Everybody has their individual programs, and it comes down to more than what the union is. I wouldn't join a union myself. I believe what needs to be done is the drivers, each depot needs to be investigated, because we're finding out from the depot that I work at where our manager could be taking a minute off of our routes every day. Times that by 100 people. That's 100 minutes a day, 200 minutes a day. That adds up to a lot of insight. We get offered, you know, our medical and everything, but it's so high, we can't afford it anyway. But I do want to say I love my job. I would not strike. This is not the way to do it. I respect my young people that I transport every day, and I will do it till I retire, because I believe there's a purpose out there, and we are so important to these kids that we transport every day.
You are absolutely right. And Debbie, thank you very much for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Well, at least I see this as part of the war on the car, although I don't know if Katie Shepard's going to agree with me. She is one of the star reporters at Willamette Week. You find them at WWeek.com, and she has a bang-up story. I had no idea that here in the Pacific Northwest is the city that ranks almost at the top, or I guess at the bottom, of the pile in America when it comes to car theft. Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So where does Portland rank exactly in terms of car theft in America?
So among the 30 largest cities in the U.S., Portland comes in third for car thefts per capita. So for every 100,000 people, Portland has the third most car thefts.
All right. So which are the cities that are worse than Portland in that regard?
Just Detroit and Baltimore.
Detroit and Baltimore. Talk about a couple of crime-swollen cities. Not exactly. I had to guess that maybe it would be L.A. or New York, but no. L.A. and New York are actually better for car theft than Portland is.
Quite a bit better, actually.
And there's a reason for that you identify in your story, isn't there?
Yeah, so there are kind of two primary things that my story talks about that are driving the car thefts. And the first one is the problem of drug addiction and homelessness in Portland. But the second one is something that you might not expect, which is two appeals court decisions from 2014 and 2015 that made it extremely difficult for prosecutors to move forward with some of these cases and get convictions for people who are arrested in stolen cars. So because the appeals court decided that in order to get a conviction, prosecutors have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person in the stolen car knew that it was stolen.
What?
They've had to decline a lot of these cases.
Hold on. How would you ever prove that somebody knew a car was stolen?
Well, that's the barrier facing the prosecutors now. And it is really, really difficult.
Well, I mean, are there cases where they could actually prove that? Because how would you? I mean, you might think, well, it's obvious. If somebody is in a car and they don't own the car, then, of course, they would know it is somebody else's car. And if they don't have authorization to use it, the technical name of car theft is unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. If somebody didn't say you could use the car, then why would you think that you could? How did the appeals court reach this cockamamie conclusion that you have to prove the person knew it was stolen?
So there are a couple of reasons in the two cases that were overturned. In the first case, the main reason that they said that they couldn't prove that the man who was in the car knew it was stolen is because he claimed that he had gotten it from a friend. He actually happened to be in jail the day that the car was originally stolen.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of evidence that probably should have suggested that he knew or should have known that the car was stolen. There was damage to the ignition. He was using a key that didn't belong to the car. He had a kit full of burglary tools that was labeled crime committing kit. So
he had a label on it that said crime committing kit.
Yeah, amazingly.
It's an OCD kind of car thief or what? I mean, he had to. It just seems odd that a criminal would actually label something car stealing or car getting kit.
Crime committing
kit.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty strange.
So the result of this, and the thieves know what the rules are, right?
Yeah. So I talked to police officers and prosecutors and defense attorneys who all told me that they have talked to people who have been arrested and people that they're either prosecuting or defending in court who say that they've been talking with other people on the street and that word is getting around that if you kind of stick to this story that you got the car from a friend or you're borrowing it from somebody that you know, unless there's some really compelling evidence that you stole the car, you can typically get away with it.
Because just like the person who would have the crime committing kit, you might also have that good backup story in your hip pocket for when you get caught. As a result, how much has car theft gone up in the last 3 years alone?
So in the last 3 years, motor vehicle theft has increased about 50% between 2013 and 2016. This year, thefts are already higher than they were in 2016, so that could be an even greater increase, but we won't know until the end of the year.
Yeah, you pointed out in your story, by October of this year, the number of auto thefts had already exceeded the number of auto thefts in all of 2016. So we may be heading into what, another 20% increase above last year?
It's hard to tell at this point because those last few months of statistics aren't in yet, but it could be quite a bit higher.
Okay, now my next question is there a way to fix this by changing the statute on car theft to get around that appeals court decision? And if so, why hasn't the legislature taken some action on it? They had a session this year in which they didn't seem to get much of anything done, but they could have fixed this.
They tried. So the House Judiciary Committee proposed a bill that would have closed this loophole and would have clarified what kind of evidence prosecutors could use to show that somebody knew a car was stolen.
Yeah.
So things like having shaved keys, using a screwdriver to operate the ignition, damage that suggested that the car had been broken into, those kind of things would have supported their cases. And you know, anybody in a car like that should probably know that it's stolen.
So, Katie Shepard, what happened to that bill? I mean, they had a Democrat majority in Salem. Couldn't they pass it?
So what ended up happening is that the bill got a pretty sizable cost estimate attached to it. So the fiscal impact was going to be about $1 million in the first year and an additional $4 million.
Hold on. I'm trying to understand this. How does it cost more just to tell the police you can use these things to prove that somebody knows the car is stolen? How does that increase the cost? The cops are already there. The courts are already there. The DAs are already there.
Well, if they're able to get more convictions, then it stands to reason more people will be going to prison, and you'll have to add prison beds, and that costs money.
Gee, it probably costs money to buy handcuffs, too, and maybe interview rooms and little detective notepads for the detectives. They really shot the bill down because it was going to cost more money to actually convict car thieves?
Well, it got that high cost estimate, and then it went to the Ways and Means Committee, and it died there. And a lot of everyone that I talked to who was involved in drafting the legislation and trying to push it through said that they thought it was killed because of the high cost.
Unbelievable. Katie, I'm going to advise people to read your whole story. It is fascinating, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk about it today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Katie Shepherd. You can find her at WWeek.com, a story about how this Pacific Northwest city, the one we broadcast from, where our broadcast studios are, Portland, has the third highest per capita car theft in America, only eclipsed by the crime centers of Detroit and Baltimore. And why is it? Because you have to prove that the car thief driving the stolen car knew that the car was stolen. And when the legislature was offered a fix, their answer was, well, gosh, it'll cost more money if we catch more car thieves and lock them up, so we should just let them keep on stealing cars. Why not? To your calls now. Naysayer Diane's on the line from Seattle, listening on Talk Radio 570. Diane, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, thank you, Lars, for taking my phone call. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
Long-time listener.
Thank you.
My naysayer opinion is about the first student bus strike going on in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of... I have mixed messages regarding unions. I was involved with the union for many, many years, not the bus drivers union or anything, but without that union, I wouldn't have a pension right now. And
you wouldn't have been able to put money for yourself in an IRA?
Not with the profession I was in, no, absolutely not.
Why not?
I was a waitress.
Oh, okay.
I was a waitress. And, you know, there's good doctors, not so good doctors. There's irresponsible people out there. It's human nature. And I agree, though, the unions have become way too politicized. They've lost their vision in recognizing and wanting to truly represent workers' rights. And I don't mean getting $15 an hour over at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally ridiculous.
Okay, but let's get to the question is, today, Seattle bus drivers are on strike. They decided to stiff a bunch of little kids for getting to school. And they'll go back to work tomorrow. And the bus drivers say this is a legitimate way to send a message that they are not happy with their health insurance plan. Is it?
It's not getting public support, that's for sure. That's what they really need. They have to get public support. But then on the other hand, they have the right to receive adequate health insurance.
But where is that? Where do you find that right?
You have to fight for it.
No. Where do you find that right? You referred to it as a right. Now, I know about my right to free speech. I know about my right to keep and bear arms.
It's a privilege. Okay, it's a privilege.
I'm just saying it's
a privilege.
Yeah.
Okay, but if management isn't willing to supply it, and you need to let them know that you want it, you need it, and we do. We need some form of health insurance.
Well, they say that the health insurance they like, they just don't like paying for it. So every time you don't want to pay for something, you go on strike and stiff a bunch of little kids?
Well, no, absolutely not. But we, as the public, do not really have the full information of what is on the negotiating table either. Members don't even know.
The unions,
they don't know.
The unions could tell us. They could come out to the public and say this is what's been offered, but the unions typically don't tell the public what the issues are.
You're absolutely right there. They don't.
Well, if they want the public to know, they got to tell the public. Diane, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Back in just a moment. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to serve the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio. By the way, tonight on KGW Channel 8, I do my little left hook, right jab feature with Steve Novick. He's got the left hook. I've got the right jab. And we debate, actually, what should happen with members of Congress who commit sexual offenses against their staff. Should the taxpayers pay for that, or should the members of Congress pay for it? That's in their 6 o'clock show tonight on Channel 8. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got an idea. Try this on for a wild idea. You've heard the reports that in Congress, there are staffers who've alleged sexual harassment, and that as a result, about $15 million has been paid out over the last 20 years, which is actually, when you divide it down to the number of employees and the number of complaints that might have been filed over 20 years involving Congress, which is an entity that employs tens of thousands of people, that the biggest problem there is that members of Congress who are accused of some kind of sexual harassment of employees can have the taxpayers pay the cost of paying off those people so that those complaints of sexual harassment don't turn into lawsuits against the member of Congress. So I have an idea that resolves this problem. Pass a law that says that when a member of Congress is accused of sexual harassment, if they want to settle the case out, they can do so if they want to do that before they go to trial. But two things must happen. Number one, the settlement has to be paid out of the congressman or congresswoman's personal funds. And number two, the payment for sexual harassment must be publicly disclosed. So once a year, once a quarter, once every 6 months, the member of Congress, if they've had a sexual harassment claim against the congressman, not against other members of the staff. And what I mean by that is I can imagine a congressman employing, and they employ a lot of younger people straight out of college, and they have some other folks. And if they decide, you know, to commit sexual offenses against each other, and I'm sure that happens from time to time, and there is a complaint, you can resolve that complaint, but that's not the congressman's fault because he's not policing the private activities of his individual employees. But if the congressman, as in John Conyers, who paid off $27,000 using taxpayer money to silence a young woman who said that he had tried to sexually assault her or demand sexual favors from her. That should have been, one, paid for with John Conyers' money, and two, it should have been publicly disclosed. Add those two to the law, and I think the number of sexual offenses by members of Congress would drop dramatically. Let's go to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
So earlier you were talking about Portland's car theft problem, and I have a great example of Portland's apathy to the problem. About 4 years ago, I had an older Honda Civic that was parked in front of my house. Yeah. And, you know, it had those key locks that were really easy. There was an older car. Somebody basically got into the car and then stole it using a makeshift key. I was a lucky one that about 48 hours later, the police call me about 11:30 at night, say that they just pulled somebody over in the car and it's at a gas station close to my house. I go up there, I get the car, I watch them actually arrest the girl that was in the car. And 2 days later, I get a call from the DA giving me an update on the case. And the DA from the city of Portland called me to tell me that they were not going to press charges against the person that they found in the car. And I said, how is that possible? You know, she didn't have a key that belonged to the car. There was, she wasn't authorized to know her. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. The story that the girl gave the police at the time, even though they arrested her that night, was that she had gotten this makeshift key from a cousin, is what the DA told me. I asked the DA, well, then why wouldn't you press and find out if who's the cousin? Who's the cousin?
Yeah.
And they said that she refused to answer, and that the Portland police don't have the resources to investigate that any further. Yep. And they let her go.
So you're hearing exactly what Katie Shepard said in the Willamette Week story, and that is they can't prove that she knew it was a stolen car. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment on Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. But first, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program a former assistant advisor to President Donald Trump and now national security strategist for Fox News and a lecturer and consultant at the Heritage Foundation, Dr. Sebastian Gorka joins me now. How you doing, Doc?
Really
really well, Miles. Thanks for having me.
I know that you got a little bit of a shaky phone connection, but I wanted to ask you about this. So yesterday we see North Korea, the little crazy man, launch off another missile. This one, we're told, has the kind of range that if launched in, you know, in an attack mode, you know, at the proper, you know, this one launched pretty much straight up and straight down or pretty close to it, but they could have reached Washington, D.C. with this missile. Is it time at this point to do something meaningful that stops North Korea from getting further down this road or farther down this road in its ambitions to have both nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles to deliver them?
There comes a point where a reasonable nation must consider the use of force. Yesterday's action is a repetition of what we've seen in the past, which translated into English is that North Korea, Pyongyang, has zero interest in de-escalation. After the last launch, the Secretary of State was clear. There is immediately two things that Pyongyang could do to indicate their desire to avert conflict, and that would be to stop nuclear detonations, the illegal nuclear bomb test, and second is to desist from the illegal ballistic missile launches. They have clearly refused to do so, and at the end of the day, diplomacy can only get you so far, love.
Well, Dr. Gorka, I know that when you worked as an advisor to the president, you were very careful not to telegraph strategy, and I understand the concern. Your concern probably continues today, even though you're now outside the White House and you're free to comment. But I've heard people saying, different commentators saying, well, of course, there are no military options here. But aren't there always military options where we could say to North Korea, or the president could say to North Korea, if you continue this path, then we will be forced to use, say, conventional weapons to wipe out some of your launch sites, and then you'll get another chance to stop. And if you don't stop, we will keep doing that to take away your ability to launch. Or alternatively, could we tell South Korea and even Japan to use weapons that we could supply to them to start knocking these missiles out of the air as they're being launched to deny North Korea the kind of data that they're getting from these test shots?
Lars, you're absolutely right. There are always options. It was the Obama administration, especially with regard to Iran, that gave us the false dichotomy that either you have diplomatic relations with a country or you're at full-out war with them. Of course, that's absurd. We are the most powerful nation the world has ever seen. As such, we have a cornucopia of overt military options and more covert military means to undermine our adversaries like North Korea. So it could be a surgical strike. It could be some kind of cyber attack. You name it. The idea that any military action we take results in a rematch of the Korean War is absolutely asinine.
Well, how much do you think of that is going on right now behind the scenes? For example, we wouldn't necessarily see some visual evidence on CNN or on Fox News that we had launched a cyber attack against North Korea's computer infrastructure, but it might be working anyway. Do you think that's going on right now?
No comment, but there's been a lot of failed tests. All I can say is there have been a lot of failed tests in North Korea.
All right. So how much farther do we let this guy go?
I think yesterday the message was clear. It wasn't just the president, it was Secretary Mattis, who said that you will be destroyed. I mean, there will be a physical retribution if there is a threat made against our territory, including Guam, not just the mainland. So that is the purview of the president. The president will decide, when he has the requisite intelligence signals that there is something imminent about to occur to ourselves or to our friends and allies. And, you're absolutely right. We don't give our game away. This administration is very, very different. But when the requisite intelligence lands on the president's desk, he will take the requisite decision.
Dr. Gorka, let me ask you about this. There's an issue going on right now, kind of launched over the last 24 hours, that President Trump has been retweeting some images, videos, and other, you know, kinds of visual, you know, documentation of attacks by Muslims of, you know, in various other countries, including people being thrown off buildings and that sort of thing. And I see the usual suspects among the liberal media saying, well, this is outrageous that the president would do this because it's dividing communities. But if the videos are real, and Doc, you and I have both seen videos, they're in the public domain, of Muslim terrorists beating people, throwing them off of buildings because they're gay or they've somehow crossed the prophet one way or another, of people having their heads cut off, of people being burned alive in cages. And there are folks saying that the president is wrong to retweet these images, even though it doesn't sound like they're saying the images aren't real. They're just saying that they think it's not politic for the president to do this. I'd like to get your take on it.
Those factual depictions shatter the Alice in Wonderland fantasy world that the left has been trying to peddle to us for almost a decade. So, yes, I mean, you can have issues with the purveyor of those images from the UK. I'm not familiar with the original individual that posted them, but that's irrelevant. Either the images are real or they aren't. If they're real, and we know that this is happening, we know that in Sweden, we know that in France, we know that in Germany, there has been a massive undermining of national security and just civil society in general because of the unfettered immigration that undermining of the safe societies that existed prior to those immigration policies. So, yes, this is a real issue, but of course it burst the left's bubble. That's the problem for the mainstream media.
Well, it's just strange for me to watch reporters, you know, come unglued about the reposting of things that, and if they were saying these are false images or they were created, it'd be one thing. But even in that case, it might be defensible from the standpoint that that you say, well, they depict the kinds of things that have been well documented in the Muslim world for a good long time. And as far as I can tell, and I wasn't also aware of this woman in Great Britain who's been posting a lot of these, but all they're saying is it's controversial that she posts them, not that she's putting up fake information, but just that the images are shaking, are disturbing to people. Well, you know, the images of Auschwitz and Dachau are also disturbing to people, but I certainly wouldn't restrict the publication of them because I think the publication of them serves a purpose.
But Lars, you're undermining their narrative.
Well, you're right, I am. And I'm working hard at it, Doc.
Right? I mean, remember, you know, as my good friend Chris Plant says, as the radio show here in D.C., on the left, reality is optional. And in some cases, reality damaging to their narrative. So, of course, this faux outrage is simply a function because what the president is reposting as a factual artifact undermines everything the left's been telling you about Islam, about the threat to modern democracies for the last decade or more. So again, it just illustrates it's not about the truth, Lars, it's about the narrative for the left.
Dr. Gorka, it's always a pleasure. I'm glad to hear that you're now working with the Heritage Foundation and, of course, your national security strategist for Fox News. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lars. God bless you and the listeners.
You bet. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, former advisor to President Donald Trump. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Oh, I loved watching this story from Olympia, Washington, where authorities had to confront dozens of anti-fracking protesters who blockaded railroad tracks for more than a week. The Olympia police tweeted out early today that they warned people to stay away from the area near downtown, where Union Pacific Railroad officers confronted 20 to 30 masked protesters. Now, a mask on a protester tells me they're ashamed of what they're doing and they don't want to be identified. The crowds dispersed and the officials are now sweeping the encampments for bombs to clean up the site. The protesters wanted to block trains that were carrying sand, fracking sand. It's the kind of sand that's used after they do hydraulic fracturing They put the sand in to keep that rock open so that the oil can be taken out. They also do it for natural gas. It has been one of the biggest developments in favor of cleaning up the environment by having more natural gas available, and the anti-fracking crowd doesn't like it. Let's go to naysayer Brian. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program. You know on this program, naysayers go first. What's on your mind today, and where do you and I disagree?
Hey, I just wanted to say that thanks for taking my call, and I don't think that they should cut the taxes.
You don't think we should have a tax cut? Why?
Well, I think we need to save money.
How do you save my money by giving money to the government? Because the government has been one of the biggest spendthrifts I've ever seen in my life.
The government's basically a giant insurance program with a standing army.
How is it an insurance program? What do they insure against?
They insure old people going into nursing homes and old people getting knee replacements and old people not going hungry. They insure from poor people not being strong enough when they turn 18 to join the military, do Medicaid.
Except for this, the government spends beyond its means, and it has now racked up on our behalf $20 trillion in official debt and another $100 trillion in obligations. Some of those obligations are the things you just mentioned that you're so enthusiastic about, that is taking care of the elderly and taking care of the poor. The problem is we've made over $100 trillion in promises, and we don't have the dollars to back them up. So if we keep taxes high, how does that help anybody?
My question is the tax cut. I'm fine with a tax cut as long as you can pay for it.
Pay for it?
They're not.
Well, how do you pay for something when the government is going to take your money? Do you assume the government
by cutting something?
No, hold on, Brian. Do you assume the government owns 100% of your paycheck?
No. Hold on. What you asked me a question. I was going to answer it.
All right. Go ahead.
I'm totally fine with a tax cut as long as they pay for it.
I'm asking you a question about that.
How do they pay for it? They would need to cut something.
But Brian, you're not paying for something if the government says you can keep more of your own money, unless you assume that the government already owns your entire paycheck and you only get to keep what they decide to let you keep.
I'm not following your logic there. What I'm talking about is the financial stability of our federal government and the national debt.
Well, I am too. But when I pay for something, I go to somebody willingly and I hand them a dollar in exchange for something they have that I want, like an apple. When the government says we can't take less of your tax money unless you somehow pay for it, well, you know, I don't understand the logic. The government owns my whole paycheck except what they're going to give me back.
Well, let's say you're a big company like Walmart, right?
Okay.
And you want to cut Walmart's taxes.
Yeah.
I would say that Walmart's taxes help pay for all the military bases in the Philippines and Okinawa that help maintain we protect the shipping lane.
Well, all of our taxes pay for that. All of our taxes pay for that. And by the way, out of a $4 trillion budget, do you know how little of that goes to the Pentagon?
About a trillion?
About $1.06. Now, the rest of it, do you know where the rest of it goes to? The rest of it goes to, most of the rest of it goes to entitlements like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, food stamps, Section 8 housing. Two-thirds of the federal budget is made up of entitlements. So how do you get the economy? How do you get the economy going again if you tax the daylights out of American companies and tax the daylights out of American workers?
Isn't the economy already going again? I mean,
not as fast as it could be. Not as fast. Have you ever taken any?
My point is, you guys are saying like, hey, during the Obama years, you guys were all about the debt is terrible, the deficit.
It is terrible.
You know, we had the Budget Control Act, and then now as soon as you guys take the reins.
No, actually, we've been applauding President Trump for cutting. When he came into office, he said, let's cut the number of people at the EPA. Let's cut the number of people in the federal government. Let's cut even the White House budget has been cut from what it was under Obama. And under Obama, the economy poked along at about a 2% growth rate. It was 2.1% for around 8 years.
And now we're at 3.5.
Which is about 60% better.
Totally, yeah. I'm totally for it. But here's my question. How much is this tax cut going to add to the national debt?
Doesn't have to add anything. It's all about what you spend. It would be like saying, how much are you going to have to put on your Visa card this year when you fund your existence? Well, you can decide to put nothing on your Visa card. You could spend within your means, right?
So you're still talking around it.
No, I'm not. You're assuming
Mitch McConnell
spending is entirely within the control of the government. And what you're saying is you want to take a bunch of people who are famous for wasting money and you want to get them to spend less money by giving them more of it. Why would you think that if you give them more money, they will spend less?
I want to give them more money when we're making.
You do, because I want to see taxes cut. I want to see. Yes, I do. I want to see taxes cut.
He's a good Christian.
Well, hold on. But we're not talking about Dave Ramsey. We're talking about this.
I follow Dave Ramsey.
I don't care about Dave Ramsey. No. I care about your phone call and your opinion. I don't need you to give me Dave's opinion. I know Dave. He's a friend through the business. But let me ask you this. How do you get the federal government to spend less money by allowing them to keep more of everybody's paycheck? That's what you want. You said you don't. No, you said you do not want a tax cut. Okay, I do want a tax cut. I think the federal government spends too much money. I think that they should stop spending too much money. I think they should live within their means. Your attitude is, well, if we let them keep taking a large chunk of our paychecks, they will control their spending. That has never been the case. They have always spent beyond their means, and now you want them to keep on taking our paychecks and spending beyond their means. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to tell you something. This Matt Lauer controversy, I sounded off on it at the top of the show, and I put my commentary up at my Facebook page, the Lars Larson Show. Boy, the more that comes out about this, let me tell you what gets under my skin the most about Matt Lauer. This guy has been happy to lecture conservatives and to defend liberal politicians and others in his role as this anchor on NBC's Today Show. Now, you need to know about NBC's Today Show. That show earns around $500 million, $500 million a year for NBC. And as the primary anchor of that show, Matt Lauer was able to command a salary that included about $35 million a year in pay. And then he got helicopter rides from his home in the Hamptons into the city so that he could work. I mean, this was a guy who was very well compensated, and he was happy to lecture conservatives, to lecture Bill O'Reilly about the proper treatment of women. I'm sure, and he's had plenty to say about Judge Roy Moore of Alabama. And you know that he's always been a defender of the Clintons, and he's never really taken the Clintons to task. So to see this guy hoist by his own petard, the metaphor I'd used earlier today, and I properly credited William Shakespeare for that one, this is delicious as far as I'm concerned, although it's stunning to me how a guy like this, who always presented himself as a liberal champion of women, and the female audience numbers of the Today Show reflected the fact that an awful lot of American women trusted this guy, liked this guy. Let me read for you the first four paragraphs of a story that just broke as Vanity Fair, which is one of the news organizations that has been investigating Matt Lauer. The New York Times had a story that was in preparation. There were probably other news organizations that were preparing stories on him. And I think that NBC fired Lauer last night, not because there was an official complaint filed by one staffer on Monday. There was an official complaint filed on Monday, but I don't think that's the reason. I think that was the excuse for NBC to try to get itself out in front of a story that they knew was coming because major news organizations were working on it. Let me give you an idea. This is the guy again. The very well thought of Matt Lauer, compensated $35 million a year, all the accolades from America's left wingers, and he could sit there sanctimoniously and tell America, these are the things wrong with Bill O'Reilly, with Judge Roy Moore, with all these other people, some of whom have done wrong. Okay, I'm the first to admit that. But Here's how Vanity Fair leads off the story that they broke this afternoon. As the co-host of NBC's Today, Matt Lauer once gave a colleague a sex toy as a present. It included an explicit note on how he wanted to use it on her, which left her mortified. Now, can any one of you imagine doing that to a coworker? Sending a sex toy to a coworker and saying, this is how I'd use it on it. On another day, he summoned a different female employee to his office and then dropped his pants, showing her his penis. After the employee declined to do anything, visibly shaken, he reprimanded her for not engaging in a sex act. He would sometimes quiz female producers about who they had slept with, offering to trade names. And he loved to engage in the crass quiz game with men and women in the office called, well, blank, marry, or kill. The first word starts with an F, by the way. Blank, marry, or kill, in which he would identify female co-hosts that he would most like to sleep with. These accounts of Lauer's behavior at NBC are the result of a two-month investigation by Variety with dozens of interviews with current and former staffers. I did say Vanity Fair earlier. It's Variety. Variety has talked to three women who identify themselves as victims of sexual harassment by Lauer, and their stories have been corroborated by friends or colleagues that they told at the time. They have now asked to remain unnamed, fearing professional repercussions. Today, NBC announced that Lauer was fired. It was a stunning move for a co-host who is widely considered to be the crown jewel of his network's news division. And there you go. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go to Everett, listening on KGMI, and talk to Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I was listening to you talk about the 86 tax reform bill.
Yeah.
And in that bill, the corporate tax cut was a great idea. And to your last caller, the corporate tax cut helps middle class more than any other class or group of people.
Agreed.
By dividend payouts on 401ks, IRAs, on and on. But and to your point, my last caller, the problem is government largesse, not whether we can pay more in taxes. But my point was, in that 86 tax reform, Tom Foley, who was Speaker of the House at the time,
yeah,
said that student loan interest deduction was a rich man's tax break. And rich people don't have student loans. That's a middle class tax break. And since they took it away in that tax reform, student loan interest or student loan default skyrocketed. And now we got $1 trillion debt.
Well, do you think that the fact that you can't deduct the interest is the reason we're seeing defaults? Because I don't think that's the reason. I think there's another reason. And I'll tell you why. Let's do the math. I think the average student leaves college with about $30,000 in student debt. Now, there are famously numbers that are much bigger than that. People who've gone for master's degrees and PhDs and MDs, and they have $100,000 or $200,000 in debt. But the average is $30,000. But let's say it was double that. Say it was $60,000, and say the interest on it, I think the current rate is around 5 or 6%. So you're talking about, you know, $60,000 times 5%, is that $3,000 a year in interest? If you can deduct it, right, $3,000 in interest, unless you're making an upper income salary. So if you're straight out of school and you're making, you know, $12 to $15 an hour, your tax rate is already very, very low. So your federal tax rate might be, you know, 15%, maybe 20%. Let's make it generous. We'll call it 20%. So if you have $3,000 in interest and you get to deduct, you take that off your wages and you get taxed as though you made $3,000 less. That's how a deduction works. You're going to save $600 in your tax bill. You're going to save $50 a month. That's what it works out to. Now, you're telling me that people are defaulting on their student loans because of a $50 difference in their monthly paycheck?
No, I think that's an oversimplification.
Well, tell me where it's oversimplified, because I just ran through the numbers. I assume you had a very large student debt, that you were paying 5% on it, and that you are taxed at 15%. An awful lot of people who are just out of college are working at jobs where they effectively pay no federal taxes at all, in which case the deductibility of interest is worth nothing.
My student loan debt's gone, but the idea is that when you first get out of college, the and of course you can defer it for a couple years.
I get all that, but let's work your numbers through. How much did you owe?
I owed 70.
70 grand. And what were you paying in interest rate? About 5%?
I don't remember how.
Was it 5, 6? You don't even know?
But
boy, that surprised me.
No, it was. The interest rate on that, some of those, I had, they were different loans all compiled into one. Some of them were 8%. Some of them were 12. Because
okay, let's give you 10 as an average. So you were paying $7,000 a year in interest, right? Okay, that's a powerful incentive to pay it off, but you were able to deduct that $7,000 from your paycheck, and in the first
I wasn't I was not, because they took that away in '86 and I was just graduating in '86, but what it did is it creates a very big burden, because you're not only then paying for your cost of living, for your housing, your food, your clothing, and all that, but now you've got to pay not only the interest on that loan, but now you've got to pay income taxes on that income that you use to pay the government interest on the loan. So it's almost like a loan.
We all pay income taxes on our income, right?
Right, exactly.
Except for graduate students.
You're paying to the...
yeah.
The...
Exactly.
They're the 1%. But not to the level that
okay,
is,
but let's get back to it. Listen, so what is it you don't like about the current tax cut?
Well, the current tax cut, I mean, if you go back to the whole idea of property tax and the whole idea of the income tax, it was all done in the onset of those tax reforms to hit the rich. But
well, taxes do hit the rich right now. So,
well, I get to tell you that. The whole initial idea of it was to hit those people, the middle class and the lower class, thinking, oh, well, we won't be affected. Well, eventually it got turned around to where they
are. Do you want some actual numbers? And I'll have to give them to you quick because we're up against a break.
Go ahead.
But try this on for size. These are the latest numbers that come out of the Cato Institute, so a libertarian think tank, right? This is what the bill, the estimated current taxes on the group below 10,000, zero. 10,000 to 20,000, zero. 20 to 30, effectively zero. 30 to 40, zero. From 40,000 to 50,000, for people who make in that range, they pay $12 billion in federal taxes. The Senate bill would cut that in half. From 12 to 6. So they'd get a 50.
Oh, I agree.
Hold on.
I'm not against tax cuts at all.
Yeah, then what are we,
so don't get me wrong.
What are we talking about?
But what I am against is where they're instituting all these other things, such as the mortgage deduction. Well, they're saying, well, it's $1 million house or more. Well,
dollar mortgage or more, and there's a big difference.
I get that.
What's wrong with having a limitation of some kind? I realize it's to make the progressives happy. I mean, frankly, I wouldn't have an unlimited one either, because let's say you're somebody phenomenally rich who owns a $50 million house. I don't loan a $50 million house, but there are people out there who do, Hollywood types. Should you give them a deduction for every dime of interest they pay on their $45 million mortgage? I would say no.
I would bet they're getting it anyways because they're home.
No, actually, they're not. If you talk to an accountant who does taxes, I'm not one. I hire somebody, Jeannie, because she does a better job than I could ever do. The deductibility of your home mortgage interest goes down as your salary goes up anyway. But I don't want to get into a long discussion about this. But, Dave, what would you like the tax bill to do that it's not going to do?
I think more they need to address the payroll tax. I think the payroll tax is more.
That's Social Security. It's a whole different ball of wax than federal income taxes. So if you want that, we can go after that next. And what do you want to do? Uncap it? Okay. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. We've been talking about some of the crazy stuff involving the latest firings to come out of mainstream media, with Matt Lauer being fired sometime late last night by NBC, and then Garrison Keillor fired today. But I don't think anybody's going to miss him much. He was a little bit of a left-wing lunatic, but he was over at NPR, so that's kind of redundant, isn't it? But Geraldo Rivera, you know, you see him on Fox News. he kind of stuck his foot in his mouth when it came to his Twitter feed. He actually wrote out, sad about Matt Lauer, great guy, highly skilled and empathetic with guests and a real gentleman to my family and me. News is a flirty business, and it seems like a current epidemic of sex harassment allegations may be criminalizing courtship and conflating it with predation. How about Garrison Keillor? Well, Rivera's comments came just moments after Variety published an explosive report detailing multiple accusations against Lauer, including that he gave a colleague a sex toy as a gift and exposed himself without consent to a female employee. Lauer was also reportedly had a button under his desk that allowed him to lock his door of his office without getting up. In a second tweet, Rivera implied that the women who have accused powerful men of sexual harassment are doing it to get even with former bosses or ex-partners. Gee, I wonder how that's going to go over with the new management over at Fox News. I guess 24 hours will probably tell us. Let's go to Larry in Cottage Grove. Hey, Larry, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
I have experiences with unions. And unions pay Democrats or give them campaign funds.
Yeah.
They support Democrats. And so my question is, since their president, Obama, had the Obamacare, and that was supposed to be the best thing there ever was for the United States.
Yeah.
Why are they complaining that those bus people complaining about health care?
That's a very good point, because what you're saying is the unions help elect Democrats who exclusively passed Obamacare, and the Democrats refuse to fix Obamacare. And so as a result, when the union members are unhappy about the health care costs available to them, they should take note of the fact that they paid to get the folks elected who made health insurance the way it is today.
Correct.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. But let's go back to my original question, which we put in our Twitter poll today, brought to you by our friends at Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Is a one-day strike and stiffing a bunch of little kids on bus transportation, is that a legitimate tactic of negotiation?
No. And it's actually no different than UPS. The aircraft mechanics are going on strike.
Are they?
At the busiest time of the year.
Oh, so look for the union label there, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Isn't that wonderful? Well, you got unions out there. I know people have a right to join them. There are lots of laws that protect them under federal law and state law. And, of course, they do all kinds of good for society, don't they? Yeah, right. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. By the way, there's one thing I want to mention. This is, I think, an important anniversary that I like to take note of every single year. It is the day that Mike Huckabee released the criminal that killed four cops in Lakewood, Washington. This happened 8 years ago. And I like to remind people that for those of you who think that I always defend the actions of conservative politicians, Governor Mike Huckabee turned loose Maurice Clemens, who murdered four police officers. Technically, the place they were murdered at, a coffee shop, was in Spanaway, Washington, officially in Lakewood. I had said Lacey the other day, but it was actually Lakewood. But technically, it was Spanaway. And that was the result of Mike Huckabee deciding that a man who had been sentenced to more than 100 years in prison should be released early. And I think Mike Huckabee should always be ashamed of that. The last time I interviewed Governor Huckabee, I actually talked to him about that. And I asked him about that. Why did you do that? And he said, well, because the man had found religion and that he believed that he was all better. You know, when a jury decides to sentence somebody to 100 years in prison, you should take that as an indication that that jury or that judge believes that that is a very bad person. Now, at the same time that I'm mentioning Governor Mike Huckabee, Republican in a bad light, which he deserves, I'll mention Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Washington State, the newest freshman member of Congress from Washington State, a Democrat of Seattle, who has now, I think, done the right thing by calling for the resignation of Michigan Republican John Conyers, because Conyers is the guy who apparently tried to obtain sexual favors from members of his staff. And when they would not provide those sexual favors and they took issue with what he was doing and they complained about it, he used taxpayer money to pay off these women so that they would not complain. And Jayapal, I think, is doing the right thing, but I think she's doing it because she sees a political advantage to be gained by throwing one of the oldest members of the Democrat Party inside the House of Representatives under a bus. And she isn't going to have to pay much of a political consequence for doing it. So she gets a lot of good political hay, and it doesn't cost her very much at all. And, of course, as a freshman, she can get away with it. Let's go to McMinnville and talk to naysayer Tony. Hey, Tony, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking the call, Lars.
You bet.
So I'm not a bleeding heart liberal, but I'm a
Thank
realist.
Goodness.
And I just believe things, what's right is right, what's wrong is wrong.
Really? How do you know what's right is right and wrong is wrong? Because to a Muslim believer in Sharia, what's right is women are not even citizens. Women can be raped unless there are four male witnesses. I mean, you know, what's right is right and wrong is wrong. How do you know what's right is right and wrong is wrong? To whom?
As far as my opinions go.
Oh, okay.
What I believe to be right is right.
So within
and what's wrong,
Tony
wrong.
World. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, just like the Lars world.
Okay.
Anyway.
That's right.
So I'm the bus drivers. I'm not, unions have their place. I don't belong to one. I never have, but I think they do some good.
Can you tell me what good they do? What do they add to the economy or to
they
the good of society?
They prevent you, because Oregon is an at-will state, they prevent you from getting fired by some jerkwad manager that doesn't like you and just can say you're gone. So if you belong to a union, he can't do that.
Is it also the case that unions often prevent the firing of people who've actually done horrible things?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that a good thing?
That's why I said they do some good. I didn't say they
do
all good.
No, I mean, do they sometimes prevent the firing of people who've actually done things that were wrong
Absolutely.
And bad?
Absolutely.
But that's a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. That's why I said they're not all good and they're not all bad. Because there are some managers out there will just, because they don't like you, will just fire you because Oregon's at will.
Do you know why
that
does not trouble me? Because I think that managers like that are tolerated by upper management create their own problem. That is, manager...
Well, you're already fired, and now you're looking for another job. So
no, but what I'm saying is, if you have a manager who's tolerated by a company that lets him fire good people for no reason, then eventually that company suffers financially. Their product goes downhill, their service goes downhill, and the company gets, and they get rid of the bad manager because somebody above him has to say, why does that guy keep firing people for no reason?
That could be years down the road, Lars.
It could be.
Years down the road. And in the meantime, a lot of good people have to go out and look for another job and try to explain why they got fired.
Okay, fair enough.
All right. So anyway, the bus drivers.
Yes.
So
the ones who stiffed
the
all those little
under the
kids
bus
today.
For this issue.
Yeah.
Well, why aren't you throwing management, the employer, under the bus for this issue? Because the employer
management
is
isn't the one that didn't show up for work. It's the bus drivers that didn't show up for work.
Hold on. Wasn't done. Management is the one that's not agreeing to the change in benefits, and they're saying, in essence, to their employees, it's your problem. You figure out how to pay for it. You don't. As you, Lars, don't have to worry about it because you're a 6 to 7 figure income. When you work for 30 to 40 thousand dollars a year,
I have to pay a fraction. I have to pay a portion, and it's actually a fairly large portion of my health insurance for both me, for my wife, for vision, for dental, for disability, for life, and everything else.
I understand. I didn't say you're not paying, but for you being a 6 to 7 figure person, that $600 a month is chicken feed to you.
Well, I don't think that's not the case. I can tell you this right now. That is not the case. But believe whatever you want to believe. Do you know what I wish? Do you know what, Tony, if I ever got a magic lamp, do you know what I'd rub it and wish for? I would wish for the salary that everybody thinks I make. You know what? I would ask that magic genie. I'd say, magic genie, can you please give me the salary that all my listeners think I make?
I guarantee you, it's over six figures.
I'd be a very rich. Well, and so what? I earn every dime of it.
I'm just saying, Lars, if you make $30,000 a year, that $600 premium, It's going to kill you.
Hold on. Do you know what?
Kill you,
literally. Do you know what $15 an hour is the market telling you loudly and clearly?
That everybody's not getting paid enough.
No. It's the marketplace. It's maybe in your case, it's whispering a message. Maybe you're not hearing it.
No, some of us
hear it better.
Why were unions even created to begin with? Why were they even started?
It's the marketplace whispering this message. Let me finish this, and then I'll answer your question. It's the marketplace saying, get some more skills. Get some more skills. Now, don't you hear it saying that?
Yeah. Okay.
You don't believe me?
All right.
I mean, if you're a bus driver and the marketplace is whispering, get some more skills, they may be whispering, get a CDL. In fact, get a CDL with a hazardous materials endorsement. Get a CDL with the other endorsements that allow you to haul higher value loads and make more money. It's the marketplace trying to tell you something, and you can't hear it.
Yeah, the hazmat isn't worth the liabilities that come with it.
Somebody believes it is. There are guys out there who get it. So tell me this. You believe that the mechanism that unions use to obtain more money, which is effectively hold a gun to somebody's head and say, give me more money or I'll pull the trigger. You think that's a legitimate way to go through life?
Why were unions first created?
They were, I could tell you 1,000 reasons based on a pro-union point of view or an anti-union point of view. I believe that unions were created to extort greater pay and benefits from employers.
No.
I'm wrong about that?
You're way more, have way more information at your fingertips than I do. But from far as I can tell, they were created to be a fair workplace.
What's fair?
Marketplace,
what's fair?
Wages, and
no, but what's
a safe
fair?
Work environment.
What's fair? Does the guy who's standing on a ship in the Bering Straits about to drop a giant cage off the side to catch crab, who maybe can make a lot of money, but maybe is going to be dead in the next 5 minutes, what's a fair workplace for him? Is that a fair workplace?
No, the wages is what I was referring to.
Well, no, but they go together, don't they? Should the guy who's standing or gal who's standing on the crab fishing boat in the Bering Straits in the middle of winter in a howling gale, should he get paid more than the person who's standing on an air-conditioned factory floor somewhere at Boeing?
Well, he should get paid more than the skipper. He's the one risking his life, not the skipper.
Well, but the skipper has some other risks as well. But
we can go on.
I'm going to insist that you answer one question for me. I want to know whether you think it's legitimate to extort money from your employer by saying, if you don't give me more money, I will shut your factory down.
If that's what it takes for your employer to actually come to the table and negotiate, then I guess yes.
Boy, why
to your question?
Why is it that I find it so easy to answer questions, but you won't answer a straight question? Is extortion a legitimate way to get a bigger paycheck?
They're not looking for a larger paycheck. They're looking for benefits.
Well, that's money. It all translates to money. It all comes back to money, whether it's money for a health insurance plan, money for your paycheck, money for your union benefit, money for your retirement plan. It's all about money. The question is, if you want to hold a gun to somebody's head and ask for money, then call it what it is. It's extortion. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And that one's in honor of, well, I guess take your pick. It could be Matt Lauer, who was fired overnight from his $25 or $30 million a year job. Or it could be Garrison Keillor from NPR. There is a story out from the Variety magazine, which says it's been investigating Lauer for the last 2 months, which would put it back about the same time as Harvey Weinstein. And if you want to see a picture of those two jokers, take a look at my Facebook page, The Lars Larson Show. The Variety piece, though, quotes, there were a lot of consensual relationships for Matt Lauer, but that's still a problem because of the power he held, says a former producer who knew firsthand of these encounters. He couldn't sleep around town with celebrities or on the road with random people because he's Matt Lauer and he's married. So he'd have to do it within his stable where he exerted power, and he knew people wouldn't ever complain. Well, apparently they wouldn't ever complain until Monday, when the first official complaint was filed, and then it all came apart after that. Let's go to Naysayer Mick. Hey, Naysayer Mick, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me on. I usually agree with most of what you're saying, but there was a caller the other night, you're right to the point, that was shopping for a Barbie doll for his kid, and he wanted one that was white, but supposedly the only dolls that were available were of a different ethnicity. And anyway, the point is, it seems like businesses should be able to sell whatever that legally makes them the most money. And in this case, it sounds like he lives in an area where, you know, those dolls are probably selling more. And it seems like you were getting upset thinking that there's...
No, I didn't get upset. I just said I thought that it was ridiculous that where we're told that diversity is good, does diversity mean more than one choice?
No, yes, it does.
No, does diversity ever mean only one choice?
No, but I think this I mean, is different. I don't know if he...
Well, no, but I'm just... But the reason I'm asking it that way is this man walked into a store intending to buy a Barbie doll because he said he bought a special one in the box for his daughter every year at Christmas time, and he was looking for a particular Barbie doll. So he went to the store, and he said, I would like to see the Barbie dolls. And they showed him the Barbie dolls, and all of them were the Hispanic Barbie doll. And he said, well, do you have any of the others? Because he knew that they made them in a variety of different versions of Barbie, black, Hispanic, white, etc. And they said, no, this store only stocks the Hispanic Barbie. Now, he's from Hillsboro, Oregon, which has a very large Hispanic population, but is not 100% Hispanic. So do you think it makes sense in this day and age when we're told everything has to be diversity minded? You know, that we're benefited by having a rainbow of different people in a college, in a public school, on a board of directors, you know, in almost any field we're in. And now you have a store that has said, we're not going to stock anything but Hispanic Barbie in Hillsboro, Oregon. Do you think he's right when he says, I'd like to see the other ones? And they say, we don't carry the other ones, period.
So I understand where he's coming from, but if he didn't like it,
so
he
do
can
I.
Stop somewhere else now. Let me finish what I was going to say. So if, for example, you have a brand, if you own a store and a brand of cereal has three different types of cereal, but only one of them is selling a lot, wouldn't you keep more?
Well, hold on. If only one of, and you've said it the right way, if only one is selling a lot, I would stock a lot of that, but I'd still stock the other two. Because otherwise, I'd be cutting myself out of all the customers who don't want the popular one, but they want one of the lesser selling ones. And you see this in stores all the time. They'll stock different colors of things, different sizes of things. Because if you only stock the most popular sizes in America, you'd say, well, I don't care if you're too small or too big. We don't stock for you. We stock for the mainstream. Now, most stores stock for all of their potential customers. And in this case, this man was making a reasonable request. Where are all the other Barbies? And he was told they didn't bother to stock them. Now, I wasn't getting upset. I just think it's foolish of the store. And it would also be, if somebody had called in and you tell me this, you sound like you're a little bit liberal, Mick.
Actually, I'm not. I actually agree with almost everything you talk about. Well, and it was just
but
that I just thought
would
about.
You think
I
it would
more of a business?
But would you no? But think about it this way: what if the man had walked in and said, "What if he had called me and he said, I'm Hispanic and I know they make Hispanic Barbie," and I walked into the store and all they had was white Barbie? I would take that the same way, that the store has deliberately, slighted some of its customers by saying, we could stock for you, but we're not going to stock for you, which you're right to say you want to sell the most popular thing you can, but it doesn't mean you stop selling everything else because you have other customers. I mean, in a place like Oregon or Washington, the predominant shoppers are going to be white because whites make up something like 78% of the population in Oregon and Washington. So maybe 75%. And you know, black, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, et cetera, are the other 25%. But you don't see stores that are only stocked for the 75%, nor should they be. And I would take the argument the same way if somebody said, how come they're only stocking for the 75% of the population that's white and not for the other 25%? I would think their complaint was just as legitimate as the man who called in the other night from Hillsboro, where he couldn't find anything but Hispanic Barbie. And you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. At the risk of waking up the 420 crowd today, I have to tell you about a little email exchange that I've been involved in. I don't know how I got on this list, But some store here in the Northwest was announcing that it's a pot store and that they have this giant cost reduction down to $79 an ounce, which works out to, what is it, about $3 a gram or thereabouts. I don't buy the stuff, so I don't know. Well, in this discussion, this mass mail discussion, I got trapped in the middle of it with all these stoners who are going back and forth and back and forth. Well, one of them, Greg James, who's a marijuana venture out of Seattle, writes, I was at the Las Vegas convention 2 weeks ago. Grams are $20 to $25 in the recreational stores in Las Vegas. Ounces are $400. You can buy a whole pound of bud in Washington wholesale for $400 these days. Let me tell you why I'm mentioning this to you. I've told you that I think that the illegal trade in pot is up dramatically in Oregon and Washington. And it was exactly that that was one of the primary selling points of legalizing pot in Oregon and Washington. The argument being, if you legalize it, the illegal trade will go away. Let me tell you why the illegal trade is going to prosper. If you can buy a pound of pot in Washington State, sounds like one of those story problems from fifth grade in your math class. If you can buy a pound of pot, now remember, 16 ounces to the pound, 28 grams to the ounce. So we're talking about a very low cost, $2 or $3 per gram. If you can buy it that cost in Washington State or in Oregon, and then take it to, say, just as close by as Vegas, you know, drive 1,000 miles and sell it through the back door to some recreational store for $10 a gram, and knowing that they're going to turn around and sell it for $20 to $25 a gram, that's why the illegal trade in pot is going to keep right on going, because the mechanics of it are that even in other states where it's been legalized, like Nevada, you're going to continue to have that kind of trade because the cost differential is going to drive it like crazy. Let's go to a naysayer, George, in the Tri-Cities. Hey, George, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KONA. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Lars, I just got into my truck, and I normally agree with everything you say, but I was a little disappointed on what you were saying to the guy about the Hispanic Barbie.
What were you disappointed
in? If the store owner wants to sell Hispanic Barbies and he doesn't want to sell anything else, that should be the store owner's.
Oh, I agree. Did you hear me say he didn't have the legal right to do that? On the other hand, if he does it, he also is going to get some of the PR blowback if people begin to mention that a particular store in a particular community is not catering to the rest of the population, right?
Well, that's true.
Okay, that's all we're doing.
I don't like to hear people talk like that.
Why not?
Because the next step is somebody's going to want to make a regulation or a law.
No. Hold on, George. You hear me. If you listen to this show regularly, you know I talk about the marketplace all the time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I was so disappointed.
All I want is the marketplace to make the adjustment. And the way you get the marketplace to make the adjustment is you mention it on the air. A lot of people hear it. Eventually, the Target store manager in Hillsborough is told, hey, they're talking about your store on the radio and not in a good way. Well, why? Because they say you only carry one kind of Barbie doll and you ought to be carrying all three kinds or five kinds or however many different Barbie dolls there are. So that's how you get the marketplace to change something, is by mentioning it out loud.
Well, as a business person, I understand that, and I would never do that. And I think whoever made that decision is not really the sharpest tack in the box, but I just don't like to hear that.
Well, you know, the other possibility that he's not the sharpest tack in the box is that he's a bigot.
What's that?
He's a bigot.
Yeah. Well,
isn't it?
That's true also. But according to the First Amendment, if he wants to be a bigot,
a First Amendment issue. First Amendment only affects the government's control of your free speech. It does not affect the control of free speech by either private entities like a private store or of you or me. So it's not a First Amendment issue, is it?
Well, if he wants to be okay, whether it's a First Amendment issue or not, if he wants to be a bigot, he can be a bigot.
And he will get the blowback that bigots get for doing what they do. And I appreciate the call. Let's go to naysayer Jane in Shoreline. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program. Thanks a lot for the call. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, I'm 100% conservative. I thought this is the first time I don't agree with you ever.
Okay, what did I do wrong?
Okay, so I work retail, minimum wage. The company that I work for is forced to not carry many different things. They are not able to carry petite clothing, oversized clothing. They're not able to do maternity. They yearly they're cutting back things, and it has nothing to do with bigotry.
It's economics.
It's totally economics. And this guy that has these Barbie dolls over there, he has so much shelf space. It doesn't mean he's a bigot because the majority of his population is Hispanic.
Hold on. Jane, what does majority mean? It means more than half.
Well,
now, when you stock your store, do you stock it for half of your customers, or do you try to stock it as much as you can for all of your customers?
Well, that's making my point. We stock it for the middle of the road that's going to bring us money, and those people on both ends I feel very sorry for. I don't think I hate having to wait on because I can't meet their needs, but it's all the bottom line for the company, and I understand their point, too. So when you say 50% or what, their 90% is the middle of the road. It doesn't hit those other two ends, and they have to stay open.
Well, except that if you're trying to stay open, ma'am, and you only stock for a small percentage of the population. For example, I just looked up the Hispanic population of the city that we're talking about that has the Target store in it. Do you know what it is?
No, I have no idea.
It's about 20% Hispanic, which means 80% are not Hispanic. They're black, they're white, they're Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, etc.
Aside from them, talking about my situation is exactly the same, really.
Yeah.
We are targeting the middle of the road. The plus sizes and the petites are not the majority. The mainstream middle is, and so that's who they're going for.
And I get
But maybe in his area, they have found that the Hispanics are the ones that buy Barbies. I never bought a Barbie. So maybe that's where the market is in his area.
Can I ask you something?
He has a right to do that.
Do you think there's ever a time when your boss says, let's stock the store and we'll see how this item sells? And you stock it and it doesn't sell at all, or you stock it and the next day you're completely out of whatever you put on the shelf, right? And in that case, the boss says, let's order more.
And that's how they've made their decisions. They can't sell
it. Well, but hold on. If you're coming out with a special holiday Barbie and it comes in four or five different, you know, colors or ethnicities, how are you going to know what you sell if all you stock is one variety? I mean, it'd be like a car.
Are you saying this guy doesn't have a right to do that?
You know what?
I mean,
I got to tell you something, Jane. In some cases, I talk about rights on the show, but in some cases like this, we don't talk about rights. You have the right to sell or not sell anything you want, but we're not talking about whether you have a right to sell it. We're talking about whether or not it's right to tell your population we're not going to cater to you at all.
Well, I just simply, first of all, I've never agreed with you. I think that he has a responsibility to the bottom line of his company to do what's best.
Well, if that's true, if that's true and 20% of the population in his area is Hispanic and 80% is not, why would you only stock for that 20%? If you're trying to sell.
Maybe they found out from experience that the 20% are the ones that buy Barbie.
You could be right. Jane, I appreciate the call, and I always appreciate a good naysayer. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I had one gentleman write in saying, Lars, I can't believe you're talking about Barbie dolls. Do you see how diverse I am? I can talk about anything under the sun. And Joel writes in, Lars, in downtown Hillsboro, they have a lot of Hispanic stores with signs written in Spanish, no English, catering specifically to that demographic. And yes, the local city fathers have declared it a sanctuary. And Jim writes in, Lars, Can you still buy the transgender Barbie in the generic bathroom at Target? Just curious. You see, Target made itself famous a while back by deciding to have bathrooms that catered to whatever gender you happen to identify with at that moment. And since then, they've had a number of incidents involving people of other genders being in the women's bathroom and perhaps trying to take pictures or otherwise take advantage of some of the young ladies who are in the bathrooms, which is disgusting but true. Dustin writes in, Lars, what about Sweet Cakes, the bakery by Melissa? How about their market? Do they have a right to choose what to sell their customers based on their marketplace? Well, apparently not. And so in any case, to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go to Hillsboro and talk to Christine. Christine, you're a naysayer. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Yeah, I'm a naysayer. I came in at the end of your conversation where you were talking to somebody about unions.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to tell you my experience as a kid growing up in a union family.
Mm-hmm.
I know they have about a 4 to 5 year apprenticeship, and they've got a state of the art training center. This was like local 290. They're plumbers and steam fitters.
Mm-hmm.
The electricians are the same or better. I don't think all unions are created equal, and I question why some people, you know, why there are some unions. But what I noticed was, my dad bought American. He drove an American vehicle. He could buy a home. When he retired, he had enough money to live. He had a pension.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had a sick day or a vacation day, he didn't get to take it off paid for. It was money that he just missed. And, you know, typically our vacations were always, grew up in Eugene. We went up Highway 58 and went to Odell Lake and the High Lakes. He spent his money hunting and fishing, you know, enjoying the outdoors.
And all of that had to do with him being in a union? I'm trying hard to understand the connection because I've hunted for a long time and I'm not in a union.
I can give you the connection.
Well, you have to give it to me.
I can give you the connection.
Yeah, please.
Because he could support himself. If you go to college for 4 or 5 years, I bet you agree. The market bears whatever, you know.
I didn't go to college for 4 or 5 years.
Well, people will pay whatever a CEO, you know, needs for a big, high salary. These people are going to school, and they're learning to work state-of-the-art. They're learning to work with chemicals, you know, say, like out at Intel.
What does that have to do with a union?
Well, it has to do with them having a collective bargaining where they have a good living wage.
Stop for a second. Christine.
Let me finish.
I know where you're going. You're just telling me that everything your dad ever did had to do with his union, whether it was hunting or the kind of car he drove. I know a lot of people, I drive an American car, I'm not in a union. So is everything that your dad did that was good or good for him a result of unions?
I think yes.
Okay, let me suggest something to you then.
I think he provided a wonderful, what you need to understand.
You don't want me to ask a question, do you? I know it, Christine. I know it would make you uncomfortable.
I know you. If you can't make your point, you have to.
No, I just want to ask you a question.
People like you.
Why is it that most Americans in the private sector, 94% of Americans have dropped out of unions? They don't want anything to do with unions, and they still make a comfortable living. They still put away money for retirement. Most of them drive American cars, and they have comfortable lives. And yet they've chosen the union membership in private employment has gone from in the 30% range, and it never got higher than that, down to about 6%. Very few people. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, right. If we're talking about like a plumber or let's take a steam fitter who's got a specialized skill and they've gone to school, they've got their training, they've passed their national test.
Yeah.
They I think, have earned the right to a certain wage. Now, when you've got a general contractor who's building,
why would that be? No, but you haven't explained to me why. There are lots of people with specialized training that don't get a wage.
Intel, and you've got the general contractor who is ramping up.
Christine, you're just rambling. You're not going anywhere.
No, I am not. You know I'm not.
Well, I am saying that because there are lots of people with special.
Because there are lots of people who are in these unions who seem they seem to be able to make a living. They retire. They don't need corporate
welfare.
Christine,
hold on. You haven't answered my question though. I ask you. You wanted me to talk with you. I'm asking you this. Why is it, if unions are so wonderful, that almost all Americans have gotten away from being in unions?
You know, I couldn't tell you why everyone else is doing it. But
Why do most things fall out of fashion? Why do most things fall out of fashion? Because people no longer find them useful.
There is value in a person learning a skill and having a living wage.
And you think that can only be done with a union?
Well, I didn't say it can only be done with a union. I'm telling you where there maybe not all unions are created equal, but they've put a lot of money and invest into their...
Hold on. Unions don't put any money into their people. Their people pay dues that pay for what they get. Well, so when you say the unions are putting money in their people, no. The union members pay all of that money.
Their education, and they send people out on job sites.
With money that they take out of their members' pockets, right?
Okay.
It's not a gift, Christine. You act as though the union said, out of the goodness of our heart, we're going to reach into this magic pocket and pull out money that came from somewhere and pay for the education of our members. No, the money came from their members, and their members could have just as easily gone out and paid for that education and bought it with their own dollars and not depended on getting it through the union to pay those fat cat union bosses. You got the Lars Larson Show.